Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our second session on the Women's Christian Temperance Union with Elaine Franz, Professor of History at Kent State University. I think we all enjoyed last week's introduction, and we're ready for the story to continue.
Okay, we got it. Thank you, Ted. Okay, sorry for the delay. It's been one of those mornings. Okay. So thanks everybody for being here. What we're gonna talk about today is we talked last week about the Temperance Crusades and how all of the women from the Women's Crusades in 1873 to 1874 came out in huge numbers, launched a national movement, which then was going to consolidate itself in 1874 into the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And today what I want to talk about is another bit of context for the movement itself, which is what was C about the WCTU, the Christian end of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And to talk about that, and to talk about Frances Willard and her relationship to that, to talk about that, we have to talk about something called the social gospel movement. And I don't know, have you guys like heard of the social gospel movement before? Are you guys all over it? Yeah, I figured you might not. But yeah, so the social gospel movement is mainly what we're going to be focusing on today, because the WCTU, I would argue, is the central working arm of the social gospel movement in American culture during this period. Fundamentally, that's what it is. It's the sort of embodied social gospel movement. So I want to talk about that, what social gospel movement was, and then we'll think about how the WCTU fit into that some. And one thing to think about is, you remember when we talked about the Women's Crusades, where did the Women's Crusades almost always originate? It was almost always in these churches. And so the question is, that might have come to some of your minds, is why were the churches so willing and eager to get involved in this political movement, right? You know, which really was about passing, you know, laws to bring about prohibition, you know, ultimately it was going to be a very political thing that was also clearly a moral thing. And a lot of the ministers I mentioned preached from their podiums about the movement and things like that. So the question is, why is it that these churches in the 1870s, and then they're going to continue to be through the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, they're going to continue to be central to the temperance movement? And the question is, why were these churches willing to do this? Why did they think that this was an important part of their own work? How do these two dovetail with each other? And so I want to start with our person, Frances Willard, one of my favorite historical figures. And let's see if this is actually going to work. Ted, could you move it forward? I swear, I saw him do it 100 times practicing. Okay, here we go. Okay, excellent. So one thing to know about Frances Willard was that she was a profoundly religious person. She's a Methodist, actually. But she was always very close to her religious roots. And that actually is ultimately going to cause her a problem in relationship to the suffrage movement. She's going to get into a beef with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you know, but she's definitely a very committed Christian. And her original work is as a teacher, she's a professor at basically Northwestern, at a female college that fed into it. And she begins by teaching there. And she's largely working at these women's colleges. We mentioned that she was at a female college here in Pittsburgh. These colleges, one thing to remember is that at that time, the universities and colleges were very largely religiously affiliated, right? And also, and we'll loop back to this later, but the colleges themselves saw themselves as very much more connected to the churches, right? It was actually, and particularly like, we'll be talking about the emergence of schools like social work and stuff like that in the colleges, but those are actually really coming from largely Christian, specifically Christian, mainly Protestant, right? People who were also going to work at these colleges, but it was a much closer relationship. So even when she was working at colleges, it was very much, she had a religious, it was seen as very consistent with her religious mission. And then right before she becomes president of the WCTU, so the Crusades are in 73 to 74. The WCTU is formed in 74. She's going to be active in the WCTU since its founding, from its very beginning. But she's only going to become president of the WCTU in 78. So it's going to be 4 years before she emerges to the presidency. Before that, what is she doing? One important thing that she's doing, she's continuing to do some of this college teaching, but she's also on the road with Dwight Lyman Moody. She's an evangelical preacher, basically, doing the women's committee for Dwight Lyman Moody. Now, if you know, let's see how many people know Dwight Lyman Moody. Okay, he's not associated so much with the social gospel, right? He's ultimately going to be associated with fundamentalism, right? You know, he's going to be one of the fathers of fundamentalism, but these two movements haven't split yet, right? The fundamentalists are going to move are going to split off sort of as a consequence of what they see as the over engagement in the social gospel. But during this time, she's actually on the road preaching with Dwight Lyman Moody. So she's very much not only a religious person, but she's kind of an important national religious leader. Dwight Lyman Moody was probably the most prominent minister of his day, very famous nationally. So what I want to talk about now is what the social gospel is, and so that you can get a sense of how it's going to feed into and sort of generate the WCTU. Okay, so Christianity, Protestant Christianity in the United States is going to change in its emphasis quite a bit in the middle of the 19th century. Okay, and it's going to do it for several reasons. But first of all, Christianity is going to have to respond to new scientific ideas, right? So for instance, right, evolution, Charles Darwin, evolution, how are you going to deal with that? New geological finds that would suggest that the world was a lot older than people had thought based on their reading of the Bible. And there's also a kind of new field, particularly in Germany, of higher criticism, which is kind of looking at the Bible and trying to place it in history and trying to understand, like, well, where did this happen? And what can we find archaeologically from, you know, at this place where this biblical event occurred, right? So basically, there's a lot of work in the 19th century, particularly like the mid 19th century. There's a lot of work in sort of placing the Bible, and sort of doing this sort of biblical criticism. And all of this poses some challenges and questions to Christianity. It's ultimately going to be part of what generates this split, which we're going to see at the end of the century between the social gospelers and the fundamentalists, right? So what the social gospelers do is they start to they say what's really important is that we radically engage with the world. And so their response to some of this new information that's coming out is to say, let's lean into this, right? Let's, you know, there's new information about, you know, timing. There's new information about, you know, we have to kind of rethink, you know, Adam and Eve and like things like that. But as Christians, what we're going to do is lean in to this new information that's coming out. And we are going to figure out, we know that the Bible and the facts that are discovered in the world will always be consistent, right? Because we know the Bible is true. We know the facts in the world are true. So we're going to do both at once, and we're going to discover what that path is. But we're not going to turn from any sort of discoveries that might be made about the world must be consistent with the Bible. And so we're going to figure out how we need to understand the Bible so that we understand that consistently. So basically, what they do is they generate a more world-looking Christianity, a Christianity that is sort of based in much more sort of engagement with contemporary movements in the world, and particularly it's going to have to do with contemporary movements in the United States here. So what I want to talk about a little bit now is what some of the core beliefs in the social gospel were at this time that became much more important than they had been early in the century. And one of the first ones was post-millennialism. That is in the United States, and this is going to be true outside of the United States in a lot of places as well, you start getting much more of an emphasis on progress and much more of an emphasis on sort of human progress towards a sort of perfection, right? There had been an idea that was prominent up to the early 1800s, but before that, which sort of emphasized the world might get worse and worse and worse. And then, you know, the millennium would happen, the events of Revelation would occur, God would come down, and the events of Revelation would occur and would kind of fix everything. But what they start saying much more sort of after the Civil War and sort of with this new engagement, what the social gospelers start saying is, no, we think we can actually make the world better and better and better through science, through sort of implementing some of these new scientific ideas, through kind of thinking about how to improve the world. We think we can improve the world, and then Christ could come down and could rule for 1,000 years over this perfect world, then have the final battle, and then there's going to be, you know, whatever, there's going to be the sort of after times. So there increasingly comes to be this idea that the world can get better through human action, and that the church itself would be very important in bringing that about, so that for people after this, particularly in these years after the Civil War, and part of this is maybe shaped by the success of the Civil War in ending the institution of slavery, people start thinking, well, we really can make radical changes to moral issues. You know, we can make the world a lot better. But they start saying, we think we can make the world better. And we think that the church itself is going to be very central in bringing this about. And so therefore, charity and benevolence come to be, they've always been important to the central to the Christian mission, but Christians start saying maybe charity and benevolence are absolutely central. Like maybe it's as important that you be kind to others, and maybe it's as important that you work to improve the world as it is that you, sort of engage in sort of reading the Bible, you know, and things like that. And so charity and benevolence come to be even more emphasized than they always had been in these sort of post-Civil War Protestant churches around this time of like the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. You also have an idea, and this is a fairly new one, an idea of collective salvation, that when ministers start talking about salvation, they start talking about, and I don't want to overemphasize this, right? And I'm not a theologian, but when you read people's ministers and also just other religious thinkers from this time who are talking about, you know, how can we be good Christians? They start talking about sort of the contagion of sin and the idea that, and this is also incidentally, you know, everything kind of ties together, but this is the time when we're learning about germs, right? And like we're learning about, you know, how things kind of infection and like how that all works. And so a lot of people are talking about sin is something that actually can be collective. If you're around a lot of sin, if you see other people sinning, then you yourself would be much more likely to sin or to have sinful thoughts. So one of the problems with something like alcohol and like the, you know, kind of take it back to the problem of drink. The problem with the drink is not just that the drinker himself, you know, is sinning, but the problem with drink is that other people around him are walking by these saloons and they're seeing this sinful behavior and that it's making them less pure. You know, it's making them, it's influencing them to do the wrong thing, but also just, they're also sinning because they're part of a system that allows him to sin, right? You know, so that even, so that like to the extent, and this isn't totally new because like the abolitionists, for instance, you know, before the Civil War definitely used to say, look, if you're part of a sinful system, you know, if you're buying the products made by enslaved people, you know, you are also part of the sin, right? But this gets even stronger after the Civil War. There's an emphasis that if we're going to be saved, we're going to all be saved together, right? We're going to be saved. We're not going to be saved unless we can get our neighbor to be saved, right? And so this idea of sort of the collective nature of being a good Christian, right? But also of salvation itself, is a way that ministers are often talking, and particularly those ministers who come to be associated with the social gospel movement. Social gospel movement is going to be most associated with, it's going to be big in Presbyterian churches, right? But it's also going to be big in Baptist churches, Methodist churches, right? Largely, it's going to be a Protestant movement, though we're going to see there's going to be some other religious groups that kind of connect to it as well. Other parts of the social gospel movement, tends to be pro-labor. You know, it tends to get involved. The social gospel movement tends to have a critique of capitalism, right? And it tends to be kind of for the working man, particularly in this area, right? You had a lot of churches which were kind of jumping in on the side of like unionization, right, and things like that around this time. But it also tends to get involved, heavily involved in things like particularly the temperance movement. So these churches that are taking this position are involving themselves in all of these more current social movements like labor, like temperance, you know, anti-white slavery, like, you know, all of the kind of going moral movements at the time. The churches, because of this emphasis on sort of collective salvation, these churches are jumping in to these issues more and more. And you can see the WCT is a good example of this. The churches are also, because of this and kind of connected to this, is a different way of approaching biblical interpretation. And here, I don't want to get in over my head because I'm not a theologian. I know a lot of you guys have done probably a lot more of this than I have, but it's an idea that the Bible ought to be interpreted more in its spirit than in the specific words, right? And this is, again, where you start getting a split between a sort of fundamentalist and a social gospel interpretation, right? The social gospelers tend to say, what we're looking at is the man, Jesus. We're looking at Jesus Christ and what the meaning of his teachings were and how he models behavior to us, right? Whereas the fundamentalists tend to say, we are interested in honoring the specific words of the Bible and taking them literally as we interpret them today. So the social gospels also take this sort of, I'm not going to say looser, but a more holistic interpretation of the Bible, which allows them to focus on these things. So I want to talk a little bit about what that looks like. The manifestations of the social gospel in culture. And one thing that happens is some really great literature. There's one really famous piece of great literature that emerges straight out of the social gospel movement's desire to see to kind of focus on Jesus the man. And that is, if you're familiar with Ben-Hur, right? So I don't know if you guys know about the story of Ben-Hur and like the making of Ben-Hur, but like Lew Wallace, the sort of, you know, Civil War general guy who ends up, you know, writing Ben-Hur, you know, he's writing, it's a social gospel, you know, text, right? You know, where you can see in the middle of it, Jesus Christ, you know, comes in and plays a sort of cameo role, kind of crucial cameo role, right, in the story of Ben-Hur. But the social gospel people really want to imagine that they can see and then also sort of replicate or, you know, learn from the sort of works of Christ. But they also, the social gospelers really want to imagine, what would it be like if Christ was here today in our culture? What would he do if he lived today in modern times? So you have a bunch of books. One of my favorite is If Jesus Came to Boston, but there's also If Christ Came to Chicago, which is by William T. Stead, a very famous reformist who ends up sinking on the Titanic. But he writes, you know, if Christ came to Chicago, and what would Jesus do if Jesus came to Boston? And these are all written in the 1880s. What would happen if Christ came to Chicago or Jesus came to Boston? He would become a social reformer. He would push for temperance. He would help the poor and he would set up a soup kitchen, right? You know, he would do all of these things. So they're imagining Christ as sort of like a living person. And how can we, the central mission, what the sort of social gospelers are doing is trying to imagine what would happen if Jesus Christ, you know, lived among us today. And this is the atmosphere that the WCTU is coming out of. And I want to mention the most important text out of this movement. Anybody know what I'm going to say? It's actually arguably, people fight about this, but arguably the best-selling text of the 19th century, but nobody's ever heard of it, or very few people have today. Do you know what I'm going to say? It's the most famous, arguably the best-selling text of the 19th century. Some people make that claim, though the counting is a little bit hard to follow. But a lot of people haven't heard of it. And that's Charles Sheldon's book, In His Steps. Anybody heard of this? Okay. It was called, and you're going to get the subtitle. It was Charles Sheldon's book. It came out in 1898. In His Steps, What Would Jesus Do? Right? In His Steps, What Would Jesus Do? It was partially such a bestseller because he was a minister out in Kansas. He failed to get a good copyright. He failed to get the copyright on the book, even though he had tried. He did it wrong. And so it's free. Everybody reprints it and everything. And it becomes this huge, massive sort of bestseller. And what he said, basically what he says is, what would happen if Jesus Christ were in Kansas right now? What would happen if he just walked into Kansas? And then he imagines that the people at this church form a club, and they each try to behave as they think Jesus would if he were them. So there's like an opera singer. And she's like, what if Jesus were an opera singer right now? How would he act, right? And she becomes this religious singer, right? She only does like religious things. So there's like a newspaper editor, and he decides he's not going to cover boxing, and he's not going to publish on Sundays, you know, and he's going to like do things like that. But it's all kind of shaped. So this was sort of core WCTU. This is exactly what they're doing. They're sort of embodying this idea of you know, trying to be sort of Christ-like in their actions. They see what they're doing as sort of the core Christian mission. Other parts or other sort of elements of what happens, this kind of social gospel gets expressed. Have you ever heard of institutional churches? So there's an institutional church movement at this moment, and that is, how do you make the church more part of the community, right? You ever been in a really old church? And actually, this is also now true of new churches, because they started doing this again in like the 1980s and kind of the mega churches, but they started doing it first. If you go to like a really old church, that church may well have like, I don't know, even like a basketball court or like a lot of kitchen area, you know, like a lot of community rooms, like that kind of stuff. But these are late 19th century churches, right? So what happens is, in the late 19th century, the churches start adding these sort of community, they try to make themselves part of the community by making spaces for the community to live their life in them. Yes. Oh, they do all of those things. Yeah. 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 You do all of these things. Yeah, no, that's right. But that really begins, like, they'd have bowling alleys, you know, they'd be like, and they were really trying to like, how do we get these people into the church? You know, we provide spaces for them to be. And that was an outgrowth of the social gospel movement. So the incident is called the institutional church movement. You also have things like the YMCA, right? The Young Men's Christian Association, which is going to be followed by the Young Women's Christian Association. But again, you know, this starts a little earlier, right? But a lot of the energy that goes into this movement in the United States is coming out of the churches, right? Who are attempting to, again, like, make what they're doing sort of part of communal life, because they think that that is the central mission of the church. Okay, so all of this is, I'm going to mention muscular Christianity, because that's the last and kind of most interesting in relationship to the WCTU movement. But there's a huge movement at this time to make religion more friendly to men, they call it muscular Christianity. So they get a lot of, you guys heard of, well, Billy Sunday is the best example, but he's actually be on the fundamentalist side. You heard of Billy Sunday? He was a famous baseball player who becomes a very famous minister, you know, kind of national figure. And he'd stay and jump up on his chair, and he'd do like all sorts of really sort of like masculine. But if you actually look at images, sort of like, if you look at images of Christ, like in a stained glass window or something, that's like created in the 1880s, you might well find a sort of like buffer Christ, like, you know, like a sort of more muscular Christ, you know, this kind of like this idea that like, you know, that Christ is, you know, that men could be really men and also like love Jesus Christ. And so it was a lot of, so muscular Christianity was sort of like emphasizing the sort of practical nature of Christianity, emphasizing its engagement with the world, emphasizing its sort of like power in the world, right? And its sort of, you know, effectiveness, right? So the muscular Christianity movement, though it was coming out of the social gospel movement, you know, I see it as sort of, you know, a parallel with the WCTU. The WCTU is also emphasizing the sort of like worldly effectiveness of Christianity, you know, largely with women. Muscular Christianity is trying to sort of make that sort of pattern of behavior more acceptable for men. They kind of said, men don't want to come to meetings where they're going to have to decide like what carpeting to put down in the narthex, right? Like men want to come to meetings where they're going to be like, you know, saving the world, like making things happen, right? So they're trying to like make Christianity more like effective, more muscular. So this is what the WCTU is, right? The WCTU is applied Christianity. And the last thing that I want to say about the sort of influence of the social gospel movement and sort of its institutional manifestations is university departments, right? And so this is like, you know, things like particularly the Department of Social Work, right? Social workers come to be at this time, or the idea of social work comes to be at this time. Departments of social work spring up, sociology, right? You know, economics, right? All three of these fields are largely founded by active Protestant Christians of the social gospel variety, right? And what they're doing is going largely into schools that are religiously affiliated, and they're founding these disciplines, right? You know, economics, you know, sociology and social work. But, you know, to some extent, also something like home economics, right, which is coming out of the same time, is really coming out of the same sort of set of ideas. So basically, the WCTU is the biggest voluntary movement that's trying to make all of these things happen during this period. So they're kind of like, in many ways, they're sort of the working end of this social gospel movement. Okay, I want to talk about a couple of people who are really important in this movement. And that is, for whatever reason, my phone keeps on not showing me the time. Okay. Oh, here's Charles Sheldon. Sorry. This is incredible. And incidentally, just to kind of tie it back in, Charles Sheldon is also very closely tied to Carrie Nation, right? They're kind of in the same time. They're in the same time and place in Kansas. And he's a big, important supporter of Carrie Nation, who comes and sort of replicates the Temperance Crusades in the 1890s. And this is best-selling book. I love this book. It really is awesome. And it's also, I mean, it's actually a good read. You know, I recommend, and you get it for free online because this copyright was messed up, right? Oh, it's also old enough now that you could do it anyway, but you always could. You could always get a really cheap copy of it. But yeah, I highly recommend this. You know, they also, like, in his steps, they talk about, you know, Christians from this church. They go into, you know, the prostitution quarters, right? You know, they go and find, you know, where is sin happening? The Christians walk right into wherever sin is happening, and they grab the people, the sinners, and they pull them out, and they, you know, bring them to safety. You know, but they're not afraid. And this is, again, very much like the WCTU thing, that the Christians are like walking into the sin, right? And they're pulling everybody out of the sin. And then they're fixing, and then once they get, you know, they get the people out and they save them and they bring them into their churches. But then they're also having to clean up the areas, right? And kind of make everything pure so that we can move on to this sort of like perfect future so that Christ can come down and join us. We could have our 1,000 years of millennium of, you know, of peace, and we could move on. These guys are also big pacifists. Incidentally, I didn't talk about the international policy, but they're huge pacifists. You know, the social gospelers, they believed that we had ended war. Okay. But so to talk about some of the leaders here, we have this guy here, some of the big theologians who were major you know, social gospel proponents. You have Washington Gladden. He was actually from Columbus, Ohio. He's a Congregationalist minister. I was actually, I'm one of the few people who can say I was raised a Congregationalist. I don't, you know, it's a, I was raised in Connecticut. So that was big, a big church there. But Washington Gladden was a huge Congregationalist minister in Columbus, Ohio. He was, and he's often thought as the kind of theological founder of the social gospel movement. He uses the term social gospel and talks a lot about its theological implication. He actually writes 40 books about the social gospel, many of which are very well read, but he's also like writing articles in really popular publications. So he's like in, you know, whatever Harper's or, you know, kind of all the big magazines are featuring articles by Washington Gladden. He's sort of a famous guy. He's big on all of the social gospel, you know, elements that we've talked about before. He really focuses particularly on labor organization. But he's a big believer that at the core of Christianity is the need to sort of go out and sort of actively reform people and create a sort of clean world for everybody to live in so that we can have perfection. People in the temperance movements tended to believe that if you could cause people to not drink, and so some people kind of say, well, why do they care so much about alcohol? But people in the temperance movement tended to truly believe that if you could cause people to not drink, all sorts of problems would be ended. That if people didn't drink, A, we wouldn't have poverty anymore, right? Because poverty is really caused by men drinking up the, you know, drinking up the family's money. We wouldn't have strife between labor and capital because people would have enough, you know, enough money. And they wouldn't be fighting so much against, you know, the big strikes that are sort of plugging the country in the 1870s and 80s and 90s. They tended to think that if you didn't have alcohol, you wouldn't have disease, you know, because they believed that so much of our diseases were actually caused by or made worse by, you know, our compromising our health through the use of alcohol. Particularly mental illness. You know, they believe that if you didn't have alcohol, you wouldn't have mental illness. Because, you know, again, so much of mental illness they believed was caused by indulgence in alcohol on your own part or on the part of your parents, right? And they're thinking now a lot about heredity. They believe that if you didn't have alcohol, you wouldn't have so much gender strife. You wouldn't have so much gender strife because you wouldn't have so much domestic violence. Maybe you wouldn't have any domestic violence. So they tended to believe that it was actually kind of a cure-all, that like if you could not have, and you wouldn't have like war, like they could tie it to sort of anything, right? You wouldn't have prostitution and you wouldn't have war and you wouldn't have. So they actually had this belief that if they could solve this problem and what they're going to call their policy, when the WCTU, and I'll be talking the details about what they do, but they call their policy, do everything reform. And what they really think is that they can bring about a perfect world, a world where not only is there not sin, but there's not temptation to sin, right? A world where, you know, people have the sort of ability to be good and the desire to be good and the environment in which being good is very simple and easy. They thought that they could bring about this sort of post-millennial paradise. So that was kind of what Washington Gladden was sort of all about. And I'll go to our second guy I don't have a picture of, but Walter Rauschenbusch. If anybody ever read any Walter Rauschenbusch, he was kind of a big deal theologian as well. And he was a Lutheran, but he coined the term and Christian socialism, and he was a big believer that that at the core of Christianity was this sort of radical care for our neighbors, and that was actually sort of the only thing, you know, or the central thing that mattered in the churches. So he's going to become sort of a huge, kind of the most important thinker in the social gospel movement. He's a little bit later than Gladden. I want to just mention what, lastly, I want to mention that the movement, the social gospel movement, was very largely a Protestant Christian movement, but it wasn't just Protestant Christian. Catholics in the United States, in some ways, sort of got on board. And particularly after the Pope, Pope Leo XIII in 1891, issues an encyclical called Rerum Novarum, which, you know, was a sort of social message encyclical, where he's basically like, yeah, you have to take care of each other. You know, you have to go out and do good in the world. He issues a sort of critique of capitalist excess. But this is a really new thing for a pope, right? But to actually say, no, the things we do in the world really do matter. And it's our job as Catholics to involve ourselves in sort of political and sort of social justice issues. So we have the Catholic social gospel, which is, you know, a part of this. And you also have, this is the moment of the rise of Reform Judaism, right? And so particularly in this area where, you know, Pittsburgh is so central to Reform Judaism, but a big part of Reform Judaism is going to be activism in sort of like social justice issues. And particularly here in Pittsburgh, that's going to be a real, at the center of a lot of our sort of social justice movements at the turn of the century, is going to be Jewish religious based activism as well. So it's really the social gospel is really sort of the coming together is largely Protestant, but it's definitely also, you can see feeders coming from both Catholic and Jewish traditions into this activism. And so all of this is to kind of explain why it is that the WCTU was not only Christian, but a lot of people saw it as sort of one of the main arms of what Christianity was doing at that time. So when people would see when we see WCTU, we're like, oh, that the C maybe seems a little oldie-timey, or like, what was up with the C there? But for them, at the moment, it really seemed as though the WCTU was like almost like the working arm of the Christian church. So I will stop with this. Does anyone have questions?
So I have a question, and that is, where did the social gospel go after this? How can you offer any perspective on between then and now, how has this evolved?
Yeah, well, I mean, it never goes away, right? You know, it doesn't go away. But basically what happens is, in response to this, you have a breakaway, particularly right after 1900. I want to say it's 1911. You have the publication of the Fundamentals. But what you actually have is you have a lot of people saying, wait a minute, like, we're hearing a lot of like, oh, what is Jesus like? Like, let's be good, you know, but we don't hear anything about, well, what does the Bible say? You know, so you have a lot of people then who are kind of, you know, coming back and saying, whoa, we're not just like here to do good. Like, we're here to like read the word, right? And you know, sometimes the word's a little complicated, right? But we have to come to terms with that. And like, you know, what it says in the Bible, you know, may not be what like feels good to like the contemporary modern world, right? So you then get this like split where you get the kind of fundamentalists, you know, shooting off in their direction. I think their critique feeds back, you know, into, and sort of maybe even, you know, muffles a little bit, you know, some of the social gospel orientation, in future years. But I also think, like, we think of the progressive movement. We think of it progressivism. I like to start progressivism in the 1890s. But, you know, some people would say it starts more like, you know, 1900. But progressivism is largely this moment where the government itself comes to be mobilized to do a lot of the things that had been done by voluntary groups. Right. So what happens is the government gets a lot stronger with the Civil War because it learned, the government learns how to like keep good records and like interact directly with humans on the ground, like things it couldn't do before, right? So part of what happens is around 1890s, 1900s, the federal government starts and state and local governments, largely because churches have been asking them to, right? You know, voters start actually taking over some of these functions. So they'll pay social workers, right, to go out, you know, by the early, you know, 1900s, right? Or they'll, so part of what happens is that like some of these functions are sort of governmentized. And then we generally think about the progressive movement as ending World War One, because this is a whole nother story, but like World War One, everybody's like, oh, you know, the world's getting better and better and better. And now, you know, all we need is like Christ can just come down and just like say, good job, you know, like we can move on to our millennium. And then World War One happens and they're like, we were 100% wrong, right? You know, nothing like that, you know. There's gas and there's like, you know, everything is terrible. And it's just, they can't even imagine it. World War One is often seen as sort of like crushing the progressive movement, right? And then everybody's just like, you know, gives up on that for a little bit. Like, but so that's a little pat way to talk about it. But I do think it's a little bit, part of what happens is that the social gospel movement sort of feeds into the progressive movement, coexists with it, but also is kind of co-opted by it. And then with World War One, it kind of like gets a little bit crushed for a while.
Yeah, I just wanted to raise a question. I mean, we all know about the religious right, but I'm old enough to remember the religious left. And there was a period, I'm guessing in the 60s maybe, when there were very strong social justice movements that were carried out by the church. And I can remember, you know, priests and pastors and nuns and so forth who would sit in jail, you know, for having done, I think, protests of sorts. And so that was a time when that was very, very different than the current political involvement, and it's not the same as this, but I think there's a thread of that.
Okay. I think so too. 1960s, I was thinking of the 1800s, but 1960s, 1970s, and I remember that too. I was born in 1970, but I can remember like the kind of a bunch of hippies in the church, right? You know, they started getting the blue jean Bible, right? And like yes. The, you know, and everybody's like doing like sacred dance. And, you know, I don't know if like, you know, what all was involved in that, but it was definitely, there was a really strong religious left in the 70s, particularly 60s and 70s, and certainly part of the civil rights movement and all that. So it never went away. And we could talk about how it might've resurged with other things, right, in the 1960s.
Well, and we see our current Pope came to this country, and I think he very much embodied that same thread. And
yes.
Exciting, I thought. I was a part of the faculty at La Roche College, which is a Catholic school, and they had, all freshmen had to learn the Catholic social teachings. And I don't remember, there were like 13 of them, and they were very much this social justice substance. And so
the churches were the force for progressive social change. I mean, there was no other. I mean, that was it. You know, the churches were the force for progressive social change. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Would you say more about what you just said a little bit ago in an offhand clause, I think it was, how after the Civil War, the government got more involved in doing some of these social movements because it learned to some organizational skills?
It had the capacity. So part of what happened is like the government, like if you think about the government, this is like getting very broad, which is why I sort of like moved away from it. But the federal government before the Civil War the only representation of the federal government that you would ever see would be the postman, right? Or the post office, right? They don't have anything like a welfare until the Freedmen's Bureau after the Civil War. That's the first time that the federal government is caring for anyone, is the Freedmen's Bureau, right? So that's 1863. And so the federal government learns how to do that and develops a sort of functionality to pick up some of these things. And it's not just the federal government. Much of the stuff has been done like at the lower level. But part of what happens is as bureaucracies become more effective, they learn how to run large organizations, whether they be commercial organizations like national railroads or banks, right? Or whether they be governmental organizations, that the government now has, it used to be everything had to be local because nobody was organized enough to do anything bigger than local in a meaningful way, right? So part of what happens is we develop the capacity to do big things in an organized way and keep the records in filing cabinets and be able to look through those filing cabinets and be able to, you start being able to type things, right? You know, and so that people can actually read whatever you want, you know, like more effectively, you know, and so we develop the sort of technologies of being more decent, more centralized. And part of what that does is it takes some of the necessity from local care, right? Because then you actually could have, and of course that really is going to happen with like the New Deal, right? But even before that, that you start getting governmental entities, but also like big charities, big charities that are like, you know, stretch over the city and have records of all the people receiving charity so they can know if somebody's already gotten charity before or like are worthy of charity and that kind of stuff. So part of what happens is that like sort of our care for our neighbors gets centralized kind of in this, like everything else in America, right? Kind of between the Civil War and World War I, and the WCTU is actually in some ways an example of that, because the WCTU is only able to function like it does because it also has the capacity to be as centralized as it is, right? It's a huge, we care about the WCTU because it's a national organization and not just like some people taking care of their neighbors. But yeah, it is true that what happens is the government comes to be like sort of in some ways outcompete, kind of local groups for those care functions, I think.
Anyone? So I'm intrigued by what you said about the idea of a panacea. If you get rid of alcohol, you'll perfect the world. And to a certain extent, you know, abolition of slavery, that would, you know, bring about a much better world. And I'm wondering if you have any observations about the tension between that in a sense of futility, for example, when prohibition fails, when there's a lot of backsliding from the abolition of slavery to basically slavery without slavery, with the Jim Crow South and so forth. Any thoughts about that and the tension between those two? Sort of, this will be perfect. This is a waste of time. We'll never get there.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I think about that a lot, actually. So I ask my students frequently when I have students, and this is going to bring it up to sort of like more recent thing, but I've been teaching now since the 1990s. I've been in the classroom since the 1990s. And I often ask my students, do you think things are getting better? Or do you think things are getting worse? And it's interesting. They usually all agree with each other, you know, one way or the other, but the answer changes, you know, depending on what time we're talking about, even over the last 30 years, right? So now you can tell me, what are they saying now? It's getting worse. They all think it's getting worse now, right? But like at other times, say even, you know, like 15 years ago, they were like, oh, it's probably getting better. Like, you know, So I think that that part of what happens, and it's hard to like account for that sort of like social optimism, but part of what the social gospel movement really is a movement of, and this is what the WCTU really is a movement of sort of insistent social optimism. You know, they really believed that things could be changed, that things could be fixed, that things could be made absolutely perfect. And where it wasn't, they were energized to find the solution. And, you know, sometimes, you know, everybody didn't always succeed. And certainly the Crusades themselves that launched the WCTU, you know, they were remarkable, right? But then, you know, the saloons came back in all of those places, right? They could see themselves, they could see the failure of, you know, those very specific things they've been trying to do in the Crusades. So they had to fight and fight and fight, but they really did have this optimism. And part of it was religious. You know, they knew that Christ had told them that, you know, that they could, you know, they felt that the Bible was saying that this is what they were called to do. And they felt that therefore, if they did it, you know, Christ should be on their side and they would have a good outcome, right? So part of it was a sort of Christian enthusiasm that they had specifically, but it was also just kind of a cultural sense of sort of constant improvement that like, you know, we have all these new ideas, we have all these new academic departments, you know, we have all these new tools. We're getting wealthier and wealthier. The United States itself is becoming more and more powerful and like, you know, entering the American century, you know, we're doing all of this. So, you know, part of it was religious, part of it was just kind of in the air, but, and it wasn't, they weren't enthusiastic all the time. Like, there were recessions during, you know, during this period and things like that, that really, you know, and things like the Homestead strike, you know, felt like a real setback. They got really upset about strikes and especially strike suppression, you know, in this area, even, you know, 1877, a bunch of Pittsburghers get like gunned down, right, by the Philadelphia militia when they try to strike. You know, so these things happen and, you know, that bothers them, but they're convinced partially by their religion that we are destined to have an upward climb. And that gives them the energy to invest, I think, in a lot of these reforms.
Anyone online?
Oh, John.
I'm going to put on my philosophical hat. One of my friends, Karl Marx, was a philosopher, and probably no one philosopher has had more impact on the world than he did, but we all know how that worked out. So I guess my question is, we act the way we do because of the way we think. I think that's pretty obvious. So did anybody write a book on not what would Jesus do, but how did Jesus think? And if they did write that book, what would be their sources for how Jesus would think today?
Probably the
and,
Bible,
and how
I
his
guess.
Thinking, and how his thinking, if we shared it, would change the world?
That's a really good question. And I think my answer is going to be like, no, nobody would dare to write such a book because we certainly couldn't know that. But, you know, nobody could write the book about how Jesus thought. Yeah, and how he would think today. I mean, I think what they did was sort of simplify Jesus into a man whose one thought was, don't be selfish. You know, I think like kind of how they, you know, I think they simplified Jesus into a man who cared only about generosity to the suffering, you know, being generous to each other. And so I think like they would have said, you know, that's kind of like the core takeaway. But I don't know if surely nobody would have dared to say, what did Jesus think? Like, but in practice, that's kind of how they seem to understand him.
Discover that for ourselves.
Yeah. Not that I know of.
My modest suggestion would be maybe the New Testament was an attempt at that.
Yeah, I think that might be your best source.
Well, if no one else, I just want to say thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.